Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. Meditation instructor Eric Weinberg combines this Dharma Talk with a guided meditation to address the question, what is insight? We know that calm abiding meditation, or shine, can help us pacify mental suffering. This week, we explore insight meditation, also known as Lak Tong, and examine its usefulness in helping us to see our mind's greatest delusion, self-fixation. Enjoy the podcast.
Many of you are used to me getting up here and talking too much, having more to say than anybody should be able to say about anything. Today's going to be a little different, and I'll tell you why. The chapter that we're covering in the book Meditation for Beginners by Bokar Rinpoche, I don't have a picture with me of the book cover, but if anybody doesn't have it and wants it, you can email me at member@large@ktc.org and I'll send you a PDF. It's an excellent book. The thing is about this chapter, it's called Superior Vision or Lak Tong, which is also what we call insight meditation. And it said, while there's a wall of books in any Buddhist library about this, every single one of them says, you can't even talk about this. That's the beginning and the end.
So what all those books do recommend is that you do this by experience. The only way to get to this is through experience. And so give some exercises, and really all the best texts give meditation instructions. Now, there are many. This little book in this little chapter actually has some really good ones. So what I'm thinking is I'm going to talk a little bit, and then I'm just going to lead you through that stage-by-stage guided meditation, and hopefully at the end we'll have a little bit of time left for questions and answers, should you have them. Of course, after meditating for that amount of time, everybody might want to be quiet, in which case we can be quiet. It's perfectly good. I ran across a quote about a week and a half ago that I love, and I want to share it with you as an introduction to this. It's from Mingyur Rinpoche, who some of us have met, and many of us know. He's a great teacher in Kagyu lineage right now. And he said this. This is, to me, was just beautiful. Gradually, I began to recognize how feeble and transitory the thoughts and emotions that had troubled me for years actually were, and how fixating on small problems had turned them into big ones. Just by sitting quietly and observing how rapidly, and in many ways illogically, my thoughts and emotions came and went, I began to recognize in a direct way that they weren't nearly as solid or real as they appeared to be. And once I began to let go of my belief in the story they seemed to tell, I began to see the author behind them, the infinitely vast, infinitely open awareness that is the nature of mind. And he goes on. Any attempt to capture the direct experience of the nature of mind in words is impossible. See, I told you. Every single time. The best that can be said is that the experience is immeasurably peaceful. And once stabilized through repeated experience, virtually unshakable. It's an experience of absolute well-being that radiates through all physical, emotional, and mental states. even those that might be ordinarily labeled as unpleasant. This sense of well-being, regardless of the fluctuation of outer and inner experiences, is one of the clearest ways to understand what Buddhists mean by happiness. I think I can stop right there. I won't, but I could. He knows me too well. That's why he laughs the loudest. So when we begin these talks, we usually set our minds and motivation by chanting the traditional Buddhist refuge prayer, four-line refuge prayer. For those of you that know it, please join me and chant it with me. If you aren't familiar with it, just join in your heart and recognize that we take refuge because we have some realization that things aren't quite satisfactory, or maybe worse, and that we have allies, particularly the Buddhas, our teachers, what they teach us, and then the community of people that we share in that path with that give us the support we need. So all that's left to us, really, because we have an authentic path that's been working for 2,600 years and doesn't appear to have any let up in it yet, all we have to do is listen to the Dharma, meditate on the Dharma, and practice it. And we'll get the same result that the Buddha got, because we're already that inside. So in your heart, think of your own true nature, which is this nature of unshakable happiness, and realize that we're entering the path through saying this prayer. Sanje Chudong Soki Chognam La Changchu Pardu Dagni Kyab Suchi Dagi Jin So Gi Pe Sunam Ki Prola Penshir Sanje Dru Parsho Sanje Chudong Soki Chognam La Changchu Pardu Dakni Kyab Suchi Daki Jin So Gi Pe So Nam Ki Drola Penchir Sanje Rupar Sho Sanje Chudong So Chognam La Changju Pardu Dakni Kyab Suchi Daki Jin So Gi Pe So Nam Ki Drola Pen Shir Sanje Drupar Sho. Thank you. So we always start in a way that we know works. And Lama Kathy mentioned it in her talk last week. Is when we open our eyes in the morning, we recognize how wonderful I get to live another day. And not only that, I'm pretty lucky in the sense that I'm able to express myself. I'm able to understand my life. I have a mind. And that there's plenty of help around and plenty of opportunities to use all of that to benefit others and improve everything for everybody. That's a good first thought. So we start with understanding how fortunate we are just the moment we open our eyes. It's a legitimate reason to rejoice, really be happy. But obviously, there's a limit to it for us, and that is that we suffer different kinds of things. We suffer physical things, and as I age, I'm getting familiar with more of them all the time. But they come and go, and that's just part of the territory. We also suffer mental things, which mostly have to do with the stories I tell myself about my life. You know, like regrets about the past, should have done this, wish that would have happened, oh, that didn't happen, oh my, nothing good can come of this now, blah, 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 blah. And then, of course, worries about the future. I don't know about you. Another thing that's come with age is I sometimes reflect on everything I've worried about in the past, and basically none of that has ever happened. None of it. I have just a really good batting average at being wrong about what I worry about.
At least you admit it.
Yeah, well, that's part of this, is admitting that, you know? And so, but that's different than pain in the body. Pain in the body is here and there, come and go. Pain in the mind coming from never being present in this moment because of past and future, that never goes away. That's continual. And one of the first things to realize when you enter this meditation process is to understand that the mind and the body aren't, they're not the same. They come together from different causes and conditions. Bodies come together from different constituents of mothers and fathers. Minds, as we can easily see just looking, don't seem to have a relationship to that necessarily. You can see somebody who's got extraordinary limitations in body, say Stephen Hawking of blessed memory, whose mind was literally as vast as the universe, but his body was the most limited one, at least we know of in public. And you have to think about this. So what we tend to do with our stories is we try to make our physical world better, thinking that that'll make us happier. Has that ever worked yet for anybody? You get the right car, the right house, the right golf clubs. Oh my gosh. it doesn't matter. I'm going to be a bogey golfer no matter what happens, you know, which clubs I get. That's true. And I will mentally suffer over being mediocre, and that's the way that is. It's true. It's true. So our minds and our bodies have some, we think of it as all going together, but actually, they don't go together. They have different sources, different causes and conditions. And what Lok Tong is all about is the beginning of understanding what the nature of mind is. So the first thing is Shine. We can't get away without it. Nothing can happen without it. It is the absolute. Well, I guess you could say we create the conditions necessary for insight by practicing basic mindfulness meditation. If you're not inclined to do so, you can probably, it won't hurt you to try to do insight meditation, but nothing will happen. I mean, literally nothing will happen. One of the common ways of referring to mind, even though we can't really talk about it, like I said, always talking about it, is to think about a pool of water at night on a bright moonlit night, and the moon reflects in the water. So, what happens when you take that pool and you throw a bunch of rocks in it or sticks or kind of really ruffle up the waves? You'll notice that there's luminosity there, but there'll be zero clarity. You won't be able to see what's reflected there. You won't be able to see the nature of what's reflected there. Our minds are like that. Our minds are always reflecting what our experience is. That's how they work. I give away a secret now and then. That's it. So if that medium of reflection is all ruffled, like I said, nothing can happen. Therefore, we do shine. We do mental calming. The most important constituent at this point, once you know, you know, how to sit and how to do the practice and have the right motivation and right dedication and so on and so forth. Once you know the nuts and bolts of it, the most important part is relaxation. And that's something that often we get wrong. So the first thing I want to submit to you when we start this practice this afternoon, or, well, we're still morning, but not long, is that we want to have the right amount of relaxation. Obviously, too much, you get lazy and your mind just wanders all over the place. And you think that because you're relaxed, you're meditating. That's not, it may be some definition from somebody, but that's not it. My father used to tell me he was a good meditator. He was not. He said that he had perfected the applied art of doing nothing. He had not. The truth of the matter is his mind was always very active, and he hadn't learned how to calm his mind. That's what we mean by meditation. So the other way is too tight, you know? It's like always checking. Am I sitting right? Is my tongue in the right place? Are my eyes right? Are my hands right? Oh my gosh, I'm having thoughts. Is that right? Can I get rid of thoughts? You know, and all of a sudden you're in a video game shooting down your thoughts, you know, thinking you're going to get to the next level if you beat that bunch of incoming. Well, it's not like that either. We're going to actually use the thoughts in insight meditation. We're going to look at them. We're going to actually create some thoughts in insight meditation and look at them and notice how they change and how they don't change. And that's how we get used to the nature of thought. And the nature of thought is actually that reflection that's very close to the nature of mind, very close. Once we really are convinced of this, and it's different, understanding it is different than being convinced of it. But once you're really convinced of it, then you become unshakable. And you have that unshakable happiness. And this whole thing, just to tie this in a little bow, is the Buddha recognized life contains suffering, and he wanted to find a path that transcended suffering. This is what we have here. So when you have that unshakable happiness, obviously you have achieved what the Buddha had offered to us, at least in part. I mean, obviously, there are levels and levels, many I don't even know about, but I know that part is true. So there's an old saying that says, good relaxation, good meditation. Mediocre relaxation, mediocre meditation. Bad relaxation, bad meditation. So it's not just, it's not just having the concept of it. You have to play with this for yourself. You have to find out where that is for you. I mean, if you're a bass violin, the tightness of your strings is going to be a little different than if you're like a viola, or how about a three-quarter violin for a kid? It's all different. We're all different. So a teacher is invaluable in helping you see maybe what's right for you. So as you walk through this, if you really become interested and you want to practice it every day or regularly, it's good to have a fair witness from the outside to help you with whether you're too loose or too tight or just right. Because we don't see that for ourselves very often, not very well. We're kind of blind to our own stuff, you know. That's part of the reason that you can't read about this, frankly, is whatever you read, you're reading with your own blinders. Somebody who's just a companion on the path, Sangha, the refuge of Sangha, and you're sharing with them, and they share with you, and you'll say, oh, yeah, we're reading the same words. I didn't get it. Now I get it. It's just like that. I can't tell you how many times in this community that's happened for me. It's a lot. It's really a lot. Oh, I have one joke. Okay, so an MIT linguistics professor is giving a lecture, and he says, you know, in English, a double negative is a positive. And in Russian, a double negative is a negative. Oddly enough, there is no language in the world where a double positive is a negative. A voice from the back room says, yeah, right. See what I mean? We need this from each other. We need to help. We need to help one another. All right, so there's one more conceptual thing I want to say before we start with the meditation practice. One of the things that's helped me the most over the years is the original teaching in Talopa's Ganges Mahamudra, that mind is like, when you first start to calm down, it's like being at the top of a mountain where the rivers are rushing and everything is just chaotic. If you ever go white water rafting, you've seen that and possibly even enjoyed it. But there's debris everywhere, sticks in the river, rocks moving because the water is so powerful and all that. As you go down further, obviously, the river widens and deepens, and it appears to get more calm. Actually, anybody having the opportunity to swim across a vast, calm river might find that the undertow is way more powerful than anything you'll ever experience in whitewater, and you got to be careful because it is so powerful. Ultimately, as we know, the water makes it to the sea, and the sea is vast. The thing that helped me the most is that there are waves in the sea, and I came to recognize, somebody pointed out to me that my mind is like the sea, and the waves are like thoughts. Interestingly enough, the thoughts think themselves, sort of. It's like I have an angry thought and I think, I am angry, right? I don't look at the nature of the thought. I'm totally convinced that the story is what it's all about. I'm totally convinced that the narrative is the truth. That's just as a reference point. That, in part, is what's called reifying a thought. You're taking a mental energy that itself is just an energy. It's a current in that water that has become a wave. And rather than the wave recognizing, oh, I'm water. No. it becomes, oh, I'm angry, or oh, I'm happy, or oh, I'm disgusted, or whatever. I mean, this happens every day anymore on the nightly news. You know? It's a great time to watch your mind, because these are just energies in our minds. And that's what we're going to begin to work with here, is these energies in the mind, so that we begin to directly experience, not just understand, but experience the waves of thought in our mind as being water, instead of being whatever we want to label them as. Okay? So, that's enough, as I've said plenty. The rest of it, I'd encourage you to read this chapter, because I'm leaving a lot out in order to do this meditation, and it's excellent. It's just excellent. I'm going to actually use Bokar Rinpoche's words to guide this meditation, because they are excellent, and I think they will help. So what I want you to do first is to take literally about 1 minute or two just to calm down. Lama Yeshe Jamso used to say there are only two forms of meditation, even though there are millions of kinds. One is calming down, and the other is waking up. And you can't wake up until you calm down. So we're going to start with that. So just let the thoughts that come, come. And when you realize that your mind is on thought, simply unhook from it and return to your breath, and you'll calm down. If the sounds in the hall are distracting, realize that your attention has gone out to those thoughts. They will come and go, so just unhook from them. And reel your attention back in and rest it on your breath. So we have a little taste of calm mind and feeling of well-being. Now let us investigate where this calm mind resides. Is it in our head? Is it in a determined place within our body? Or in the body as a whole? Is it in our heart? Is it in our brain? What is the essence of this calm mind? Where does it dwell? Let us examine this carefully. So meditate on where you see the calm mind. I bet you didn't find anything, did you? Pokhar Rinpoche says, the unfruitful character of the investigation leads us to discover the non-localization of the calm mind through our own experience. Wherever we looked for it, it was not to be found. It was nowhere. We will now give up the examination and resume Shine as before. So, do a little calm abiding meditation. We'll be going in and out like this. So whatever thought arises for you, just unhook from it, let it go, and return to your breath. To reestablish that feeling of calm and well-being. Now recall, the investigation did not allow us to discover the mind wherever it exists. However, leaving our mind at rest, we really have the feeling that a mind at rest does indeed exist. The feeling of happiness, calm, of something that exists, a sense of being. When we do not proceed with an examination, we experience the existence of this calm mind. When we then look at the essence of this calm mind, we cannot in any way say it is this or it is that. We are totally incapable of describing what it is because we are unable to find anything we could call a calm mind. If, however, we find anything we could call a calm mind, if we were to conclude that this calm mind does not exist at all, we would be contradicting the feeling of being which we experience while our mind is at rest. We are led to the discovery of a state of inexpressible being. Recognizing this and directly experiencing it is what is referred to as Lok Tong, or superior vision. This recognition is still possible through the alternation with meditation. One certain level of experience with meditation is attained. These two states are no longer disassociated, and the exercise of alternation becomes superfluous. Reaching this non-separation of the calm mind and the investigating mind is superior vision in the fullest meaning of the term. Nevertheless, proceeding by alternation is our first approach. The thing is to go step by step in this training so that you can build the experience of it. Having somebody tell you about it is kind of like having the map of a territory but never visiting the territory. We're going to go there. That's the whole point. Okay, now, you can see the shrine back behind me, right? It's lit up by the lights and easy to see. So now close your eyes and look at them in your mind. Look at the image of the shrine in your mind. This is very interesting. So I asked you to imagine the shrine in your mind, and probably all you could imagine was kids in the back room. No, this is important. This is important because this is what happens. Our minds actually only entertain one thing at a time. Even if it's moving really fast, still one thing at a time. And that's actually part of the practice. They just jumped the gun, or I went too slow to get there in time. But so anyway, in your mind's eye, the thought of the shrine is now present. Where did it come from? What location did it come from? What is its source? How did it get in your mind? So ask yourself that, meditate on that for a minute. Examining the origin of this thought, we cannot say that it comes from the outside, nor can we discover its source inside our physical organism. The thought of the shrine was not introduced into our mind in the manner of a person coming from outside into a room. It's there without having come from anywhere. We are powerless to find any origin for this thought. Now, when the thought of the shrine is present in our mind, where does it dwell? Can you find it? Is it here? Is it there? Outside or inside your body? Carefully examine this. When a person enters the room, he or she comes from outside, crosses the threshold, and then remains in a limited and defined location in the room. Can we, in a similar fashion, identify a limited and defined location where the thought dwells. So see if you can figure out where it came from and where it stays. And when it goes, where it goes. Just for a minute. So there's one more question about this. What form does it have? Not the mentally perceived image of the shrine, but the thought itself. Does it have a shape? Does it have a size? Can we see it? Once again, our investigation turns up empty. We find nothing. So let's look at the flowers instead. Okay, can you see the flowers clearly in your mind's eye? Is the thought of the shrine still there? Where'd it go? Can it be there at the same time that your mind is occupied with looking at the flowers? When the thought of the shrine formed in our mind, we asked ourselves if it was like a person entering a room through a door and then remaining inside. When the thought of the shrine ceased, replacing it by the thought of the flowers, how did it go? Is it like leaving a room to go somewhere else? Where did the thought of the flowers come from? Now look at the Buddha, Rupa. Is the thought of the flowers still there? Where did it go? So meditate for a minute and try to see where thoughts come from, where they dwell, and where they go. If you can do this and maintain relaxation, you begin to see the nature of thought. It's not what we think it is most of the time, which is another thought, of course. Examining where the thought came from, we were unable to find its origin. Searching for its localization once present, we could not apprehend it. When it had ceased, we could not discover where it had gone. Thoughts do not come from anywhere do not remain anywhere and do not go anywhere. They do not exist by themselves. By investigating our minds in this way, while we can't ever capture it in words, as Mingyur Rinpoche says, we can stabilize our mind's energy that's mostly running around all over the place based on our preferences, what we like, what we don't care about. And that's what causes suffering. So by doing this practice, we really shift our relationship to our own mind and actually begin to know it in a way that we never could have known it before, because we're always running around believing things that are unreal are real. Kind of like he uses an example in the chapter of, if you have a stuffed animal full size of a tiger with its mouth open and its fangs bared, and you're a child of 6 or 5 or something, you might have nightmares thinking this is real and anything could happen. If you're an adult, on the other hand, you realize it's a stuffed animal. And you may actually say, well, Aunt Edna shouldn't have really bought that one. Let's get a nice little puppy or something like that for this child. Or as an adult, you might recognize, if you were in that kind of environment, that there actually is a real tiger there. But you'll see it for what it is, and you'll act accordingly. You won't mistake it for a stuffed animal and get yourself into trouble. That's insight into reality. When you cultivate this, and I know this is a lot of hard work, that was hard to do. It is hard to do. So simple and yet so difficult to do. But once you get stabilized in it, you actually do calm down. There's another level of calming that happens. Because one of the main thoughts that we let go of is the thought of ourself. We think we know who we are. We think we understand. And oddly enough, it's the Buddhist teaching, it's Four Noble Truths stuff, first teaching, that our self-clinging is what is the cause of all suffering. Well, what that means is we're clinging to a self, and that self is not who we really are. So we serve this false self, trying to get all its preferences and avoid all the stuff we think we don't want. And even if we're successful, we end up never achieving happiness, because you actually have served something that isn't real. Some created thing, some narrative. And we go into that. There's a lot of teachings about karma and all that kind of stuff that creates the conditions for this. But basically, if you do this meditation every day, you start to relax, and even that tight grip we have on who we think we are gets to relax. Because those thoughts, I am this, I am that, I'm not this, I am not that, those are thoughts too. Where do they come from? Where do they stay? Where do they go? And when that opens up, a lot of things happen. You get a vast creative space available to you. Vast, limitless. That's why it can't be words. Anything you can label obviously has a limit. You experience limitlessness, and there's not much more to say. And you begin to understand then why it's important to have aspirations for enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, because within that vast space and tremendous energy, you aim it somewhere that's worthwhile. And that's the other part of the Buddhist path, is to adopt what's worthwhile and abandon what's not. This is what makes all that possible. And with that, aside from saying, once again, for maybe the fourth time, people, Lama Kathy told me people don't hear you until you've said it three times. So for the fourth time, practice every day. We're sick. We need this medicine. If we stop taking this medicine, we're going to get sicker again. If we keep taking this medicine, we'll continue to get well. And you take it as long as you need it, which means that you take it until you reach enlightenment. So good luck with that. I'm right with you. Okay, that's it. there is some time left for questions, and I'd be happy to try if anybody has some questions. Would you go to the mic, because we're recording things for the podcast? Okay. Thank you.
I would just like to know how to access the book again that we're talking about.
Oh, yeah. Just email me, member@large@columbusktc.org. Just say, I want the book, and I'll send you a PDF of it.
Thank you.
Sure. You're welcome. I'm glad you want it. It's a good one to have. Oh, now I know a tough one's coming.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
No,
it's all one word. All one word, yeah.
Good morning. Thank you very much. There we go. So doing this exercise, what was occurring to me at the time was, well, this is my memory.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had, I got stuck there.
Mm-hmm.
I have a memory of this image.
Yes.
And I kept thinking of it as a biological function. And
yes.
It just kind of stopped right there.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if maybe you could walk through that. Does that make sense? I don't know if that makes
that
sense.
That does make sense, of course. I actually have the same thing. And... sure. First of all, the biological function, that's very interesting, and that's a scientific thought about what we're talking about. It's good to just understand that the body and the mind aren't the same, but the body supports the mind. It's kind of like there is support there for the mind to actually appear, okay? It's a little bit of a paradox, but it's one of those things that you get to see when you get to see it. And the only promise is that if you practice, it will come. And you'll get to see for yourself how it is. In the meantime, there are a lot of goodies. I mean, you do calm down and your life does get more free. Now, the other part is how to deal with a memory. Well, see, you recognized it was a memory. Okay, that's a thought. So you can return to Shine and just unhook from it and return to the object of your meditation. That's first. If the thought about having a memory and why is this not a memory persists, that's another thought which you can unhook from and return to your breath. And eventually your mind calms down the water becomes unruffled and you see the clear reflection again of what's going on. That's part one. So Shine is always part one. You can't do Lok Tong without Shine. That's the first thing. So, you know, I mean, I may be doing mainly Shine the rest of this lifetime. I don't know. But it's really primary. And if you do it with an altruistic aspiration and with dedication at the end, you know, you're going to get going in the right direction and Lok Tong will become more and more fruitful. That's just an assertion that I'm making. The other thing is about thinking that it's just a physical function in the brain of memory. Okay, where did the memory come from? Once you're calmed down, you can use the same practice to approach any thought that arises. So, where did the thought of having a memory come from? Where did the thought of memory stay? Probably couldn't stay without you entertaining it, by the way. It's like you didn't just say, oh, there's a memory there. Okay. No, it's like a memory. That's interesting. This might be biological, you know? And we start the narrative again. And this is all about not looking at the content, but actually looking at the nature of the thought. So it's like, where did it come from? Where does it stay? Does that thought have a color, a shape, a size, a location? Whoops, it's gone. Where did it go? So you maintain the inquiry. And the last level of inquiry, by the way, is kind of the first one we did. Who is it that's experiencing this calm mind? Okay? And then what happens is you immediately, that's when thoughts just disappear because the mind just can't go there. But that's the quick trip to having a quiet mind every time. Who's experiencing this? You see how that goes? But you can use that thought in the exact same way. It doesn't have to be a shrine or a whatever. I mean, that just happened to be here. And here it's a staircase. You know, so. Okay, does that help? Okay. Mr. D.
Well, you did not disappoint.
Thank you.
Thank you. So the, you know, to kind of decide, all right, I'm going to do these particular kinds of sit-ups, you know.
Yeah.
I think I'll do that.
Yes.
And I'll try that for a little while. It seems like I really haven't done it much, so I might be far afield, but it seems like I would probably get bored and have a hard time sustaining asking myself those particular questions.
Sure.
So is it eventually kind of just the question, you know, like the question, like you're, in other words, a state of calmness, but
right.
The posture, the mental action of question.
That's part of it, certainly.
Yeah.
I think curiosity is one of the most healthy attributes that we develop.
Yeah.
And learning how to ask good questions, certainly. But that's not all. So it's kind of like, yeah, you get bored, but then you have to say, who's bored? And where did that thought come from? And where does it stay? Mm. And where does it go when it's gone? You see what I mean? So
yeah.
Everything becomes an investigation. So the first part of the question, I think, is correct. The second part, that you may be motivated by boredom, is you have to look at who it is that's bored and who's motivated to get out of this.
Mm-hmm.
Like you could, right?
Right.
You can't. Nundro, of all things, seems to help with this. My little pitch for Nundro. Usually this doesn't get taught until one has at least progressed a fair way through Nundro, if not finished it. And it's all about training the mind to the point where we can get some insight, because we're mostly obscured. I think in the chapter he talks about, if you go to the sea during the day and the water's calm, you can look down in and you can see the seaweed and the rocks and fish swimming around and stuff like that, and it's pretty beautiful, and you can see reflections in the water at the same time. And our mind's like that when it's daytime, lights are on. At night, on the other hand, you go down, you can't see anything. It's just a massive dark shape that is completely opaque and obscure. And enlightenment is that. We're trying to get dawn and daylight so we can see this. And take some work. You know, I think Milarepa building, how many towers was it?
I think it was nine
towers. I think he got bored, man. I mean, I think, and he had problems. You know what I'm saying? This isn't easy. But Dzongsar Rinpoche says, if it's easy and full of pleasure, you're not doing it right. You know, I think it is some work, and it takes some commitment. Yeah. This will have to be the last one, I think. Yeah, I've already run too long.
Try to make it quick. First quick question. You made an allusion or a reference to the pool with the moonlight.
Yeah.
Is that a reference or to Nagarjuna? And if so,
probably.
Does he have any teachings or, you know, scriptures on insight meditation?
Yes, many. And one of the best, there are two books that I can recommend. I know you're a book guy.
I have my moments. I'm actually trying to cut back, but yeah.
Kempo Sultram Jamso wrote, I think it's called Moonbeams of Ma Mudra.
Right.
Or, no, that was, he didn't write that. He
did a
commentary on it.
Moonbeams was, I think it was Selena.
You're right. I'm confusing two things. Anyway, he did one. He did two books. One's, look up Kempo Sultram Jamso, and I can't remember the title exactly. He did one with a moon in it. It was about this thick.
Right.
And he did one called The Son of Wisdom, I think, that was his companion. It's about this thick. But they go together really well, and it's really a commentary on Nagarjuna.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's a good one.
And since we're talking about Nundro...
Yes.
And we've talked about, and I, you know, I've known this, you know, the kind of companion practices of Shine and
yes.
And insight or Loktung. But I, you know, recently in some of the instruction I got on Nundro was to, and it's kind of a follow up or, you know, where do we go from here? You know, so like asking ourselves a question, what do we take refuge in?
Mm.
And so I was thinking, well, that would be a perfect list to use this Loktung on.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, how, you know, that being one idea, how, what would be some ways of, you know, putting or using Loktung with Nundro?
That's a very good question. And it depends. I think it depends on each individual practitioner.
Oh, okay.
And that's something you might want to work on with whoever your teacher is or your preceptor or your companion in it.
Okay.
But in general, I mean, Nundro is long and arduous and all of that. Look at the mind that's doing the practice while you're doing the practice.
Sure.
The basic technique, the specific technique you might use, though, would be, I think, individual. Right. Different strokes for different folks.
Right.
But I think it's a great idea to do.
Sure.
I really do. I think that's actually, it was advice that I had gotten when I started about how to do it. And yeah, you're in a good direction.
Okay. Thank you.
I made a mistake.
Oh, yeah?
It was four towers.
Oh, okay.
He had to build three and demolish them.
Yes.
And then the fourth one stayed. But the number nine has to do with how many times Marpa needed to to plunge Milarepa into utter despair.
Yes.
In order to completely purify all of his negative karma from his murderous past. Wow. And he was unable, he was only able to plunge him into despair 8 times because his wife, Dogmema, took pity on Milarepa and rescued him. And Marfa said, now, if you just let me do it one more time, we could have totally purified his karma, but no.
That worked out for him, though.
It still worked out fine.
It worked out fine, yeah. Yes, that's a great story if you're interested. The life of Milarepa is just one of the, you don't need anything else. Anyway, let's dedicate the merit, particularly that out of all this clarity and virtue and infinite space that we can operate creatively in, that we operate with great compassion. So we dedicate the merit to compassion for ourselves and in ourselves and for the whole world. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. For more information about the Columbus Karma Taksim Choling, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music on this podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.